night, everyone. Good afternoon. This is the House Committee on Rules. It is February 16th, 2016. A couple of housekeeping orders. First, we are going to carry over House Bill 4130 until tomorrow. So we will not be dealing with that today. And we're going to start right at the top.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, you're carrying it over for a work session?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Yes, I am carrying it over for a work session. Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4051.
Thank you, Chair. You did hear this bill on February 8th. Just briefly, 4051 does establish the Joint Committee on Strategic Public Policy Review Committee. It gives the composition, outlines the duties. This bill then does have a letter to refer to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4051 with a pass recommendation and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Hoyle has moved House Bill 4051 with a due pass recommendation and it has been referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. I'll close the work session on House Bill 4051. Open a work session on House Bill 4079A. Representative Stark, come on down.
Thank you, Chair Williamson. Members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And rather than debating whether or not this is a good bill or a bad bill, I'd like to just kind of give you a run through on what this bill actually does. You can go back and listen to all the great public testimony about UGB and about affordable housing. Lots of good stuff for you guys to go back and research. I'm just going to walk you through what this bill does and what the amendment that we're talking about today would do. So, in short, this bill provides for two pilot programs to expand the UGB in an expedited manner for mixed affordable housing. That's the idea. And again, what it would look like for that to happen is basically that a city, a landowner, and a developer would get together and say, we have a housing crisis in our area. They would then put forward a proposal to LCDC, who's in charge of the rulemaking on this. They put forward a proposal, and LCDC decides, does it fit within the rules that they've written about this pilot? If so, they can become the candidates. If not, they can't. LCDC has the final stamp of authority on this. So that's it in short. Now, I know I've talked with most of you about this bill, but I want to lay out what the Dash 7 amendments do. After the last public hearing, we had a lot of really good input, and some people made some great suggestions, both about the rulemaking and about the safeguards on this bill. That's what the Dash 7s are attempting to address. The first is, you know, that we actually wanted to put a timeline on when we wanted LCDC to have the rulemaking and all that done. Okay, we don't want this to sit there forever. We actually want to get going on it, so we put a timeline. Second, we changed the amount. Previously, we had said a city over 30,000 for one pilot program and a city under 30,000 for one pilot program. It came to our attention that the current rulemaking process and the expedited process that they've already been working on uses the number of 25,000 for much of their process. So we thought it was appropriate to try to match some of the rules that are already there. So that's why we're in this amendment suggesting changing it to 25,000. The next thing is that we wanted to clarify the counties, and when we say Metro is exempt from this pilot, okay, Metro has its own hornet's nest of UGB challenges. I didn't want to come anywhere near it, and so worked with the speaker to clarify that. Now, I want to make you guys aware that just before this passed out of the previous committee, there was an amendment to it that cut out several counties. The Dash 7 would put those counties back in. However, the speaker and Representative Klim are working together to figure out in Ways and Means which counties between the two of them they do and don't want in there. I think, personally, more is better. More opportunity for people to come forward with innovative ideas. But I understand they have some legitimate concerns and they are going to continue to try to work those out. Other amendments on this. A clarification one on the pilot program. Now, these pilot programs, each of them would be allowed up to 50 acres. Okay, that's not a lot of land, but up to 50 acres. And we made a clarification about that it could be less than 50 acres and how the parcels are to be next to each other and how they're not. So that's a clarification there. And then what I think is one of my favorite clarifications that we're trying to do is the very line 13 of this amendment, going from the wording of provide examples of and inserting the wording specify. We want to make sure that any community that is considering doing this sort of a pilot program has already made really good affordable housing efforts. And there's a great table out there, table 5, that has a whole list of affordable housing efforts that communities should be going through. Now, unfortunately, when we pass laws, we can't list table 5 because next year it might be table 4 or table 7 or something like that. Well, with the rulemaking for LCDC, when we changed it to provide examples of what they've done to specify, the expectation there is that LCDC in their rulemaking would pull from that table and be able to put into their rules for the qualifications for this pilot program some very specific things from a table that's already in existence to provide some safeguards for affordable housing. So that's what it does in short. I'm willing to answer questions. And like I said, I do expect the speaker and Representative Klim to continue arm wrestling over what counties are and are not included as it moves forward.
Questions for Representative Stark? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. And I'm interested, one of the amendments changes the size of the cities we're talking about from 30,000 to 25,000. Can you tell us what that's about?
Correct. We originally somewhat arbitrarily picked 30,000, and then after we met with LCDC and after some of the public testimony, they talked about some rules that are already in place specifying city sizes between 2,500 and 25,000, and so we just wanted to line up with the rules that are already in place to make it so it's more streamlined.
And then, on a slightly different topic, when I look at a bill like this, I assume, and without knowing for sure, that there's some people out there who are thinking about making an application for this kind of pilot. Which communities have you heard about that might be interested in making an application?
So we did not, Chair Williamson, Representative Barnhart, we did not have a specific community in mind when we drafted this.
Right.
That being said, now that word is out that this is out here, there are a number of communities who have reached out to us and said, hey, we like the concept. It's not appropriate for us. One of the communities that said that we might be interested is Springfield. Another community that said, hey, we want to take a stronger look at that was Ashland. Central Point, I really wanted them to get excited about it, but I'm not sure they are because that's in my district. So there are a number of people that are watching it, coming up with ideas, but they need to go through the process, and it's going to be a little while we figure out what the rules are. And they're going to need to demonstrate what they've already done with their UGB and affordable housing.
Okay. So now one of the cities that I've heard might be of interest is Bend. Is that one that you've heard about?
Jerry Williamson, Representative Barnhart, I have heard through the grapevine, somebody has said that Bend would be interested. I also had somebody come to me saying that Bend wouldn't actually qualify because of some of the things they were going through. I don't know Bend's detailed situation, so I don't know if they would or would not qualify.
Could I follow up? Can you give me an idea of how long ago it was you learned about Springfield as a potential interested city?
Yes, Representative Williamson, Representative Barnhart, that was mentioned to me last week, and I personally haven't talked to them.
Okay. Great.
Further questions? All right. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Stark.
You.
Representative Parrish, come on down.
For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. Thank you for giving me just a few minutes to talk about the Dash 8s. Which ultimately do not necessarily tie to his bill, but we know we have very short relating to clauses, and I was asked to consider moving an amendment that was, you're gonna hear all about the all amendments on House Bill 4143, but one of them, this one specifically, was asked to consider this as a vehicle for the Dash 8s that's in front of you. So in our current statutes, we allow that if you are a 50% or more service-connected disabled veteran, that you have a small portion right now by statute of an exemption in your property tax deduction. You hear a lot sometimes about local control in this building. Our county, my county, that Representative Kinnemer and I share, and I think nobody else is Clackamas up here, but Representative Gilliam is, our county, all five of our county commissioners would like the ability to adjust that figure, but they can't because of the statute. And so by a vote of their commission, they would like to be able to set something higher than what the law currently allows and not go under what the current law allows. So theoretically, they could set a schedule that says if you're a 30% service-connected disabled veteran, less than the current required percentage, but that would be something new that they would be offering to somebody who doesn't currently qualify under the statute, then they could set what that allowance would be. You could be somebody who's 100% service-connected disability veteran, and they could set it higher than what the statute allows. So the Dash 8s would allow us to do that, and I was suggested to me that this might be a vehicle to do that, so that is what I'm here to talk about on this particular Dash 8. And it's a may not shall. Your county doesn't have to do it, but my county would like the ability to do that, as all five of my commissioners have told me that this is something that they have be supportive of.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Rep. Parrish, just to clarify, if 40% was a 10% discount on property taxes, they could then go 50%, could be 20%, and so on and so forth, and it'd be up to the county to adopt. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, they can. Chair Williamson, Representative Hussman, they could not do less than the statute currently allows, but they could do more, and more would be a less service-connected level. And the reason that this is important to our county, we actually have quite a few, almost a disproportionate number, it seems like, of disabled veterans in our county. And when you have people who are it's taking years to access full disability rating with the VA, you have people who are maybe in a 30% or 40% service-connected process that they're still in with the VA. So, you know, full disclosure, my husband's 80%, but we're still in the VA for the last, what we can kind of consider the last mile. That can take years for a final judgment from the Veterans Service Administration. And so, and Representative Hussman, what, 5 years to go through that process, sir, yourself? So, but some of those folks are people who legitimately cannot work, and they, you know, own their home, but they're not able to stay in it, and their disability compensation is not adequately covering the roll-up that, you know, the 3% that we basically get on our property tax increase every year. So our county is wanting to keep those people in their homes. We know we have at least 4,500 homeless veterans. A lot of those folks were people who started in a home and frankly just couldn't afford to keep their home anymore. And so our county is looking for a local solution. And again, this bill was suggested as a vehicle to do that. So that is why I'm here.
Another one, Madam Chair, thank you. And you mentioned your county, and maybe they're on the list to testify. I don't know, or you could answer it. AOC and LOC, are they going to testify in support or anything, or do you know? Have you talked to them?
Well, this is not a new concept. Chair Williamson, Representative Huffman, not a new concept. Senator Olson's been working on this in some way, shape, or form for quite some time. So I'm not exactly sure how they're going to testify. But again, it really is a may not shall. So Multnomah County, for example, doesn't have to do it. Or, you know, Jackson County or whatever. It's just, so it gives a local county the flexibility. It does not change the existing statute, but it does give a county who feels like they're in a position to do something more the ability to do something more at their own discretion with a vote of their commission.
Thank you. I've been supportive of Senator Olson's in the past, but never could really figure out why it never seemed to go anywhere. So
maybe for the same reason a lot of veterans' bills don't go where they need to go. So.
Thank you. Has this issue been raised with the Committee on Revenue? Because it's obviously a revenue issue.
Representative Williamson, Representative Barnhart, to my knowledge, no. I don't think it's come before revenue. I think we've had a little bit of this conversation. I think I talked to Representative Buckley a little bit about this, about would it have a revenue impact. And so there is, and I went down to LC, or legislative, fiscal, excuse me, to ask that question. And it really is, I think, one of those things that without a huge in-depth would probably come back as indeterminate, because we're talking about a pretty finite amount of people. But Representative Buckley, went in my conversation with him, was like, you know, there could have a little bit on the, you know, a distribution, changing the distribution for like public safety or education, but it's going to be fractional at best. But hard to determine, because we ultimately don't know how many of these folks there are. There are currently 100,000 people connected to the VA. Not all of them have a disability. 22,000 Oregonians have a 1099-R, which was they're actually a retiree, and those people could also have some level of disability. So it really depends on what the county actually decides as sort of a final sliding scale. I had a conversation with LC this morning on a little bit of a different bill about, you know, raising revenue, and we're giving counties permission to raise revenue, and they don't necessarily consider that a fiscal impact because it's more of a permission bill rather than the bill itself. The Dash 8 amendment, for example, doesn't actually do anything until the counties actually make that decision, so it'd be really hard to get a fiscal because you could only have one county do it, or you could have 36 counties do it. We also know we have 250,000, roughly, veterans who are not connected in any way, shape, or form to the VA. We don't know how many of those have a service-connected disability, so it's really difficult. The interesting, when you actually do connect people to the VA, and you'll hear this a little bit tomorrow on a different bill, but when you do connect people to the VA, and they do get disability compensation, that money is tax-free. It's been in the economy, so that little break on the property taxes, the minute you do connect someone to their disability compensation, you're actually going to see that at some point back in our general fund in an income tax. So it's, in my mind, it's sort of a wash, but there's not a, to my knowledge, there's not currently necessarily a fiscal on this, or, and I've not determined if they're somebody going to issue one on this.
Don't have any paperwork on this amendment.
Well, I mean, my next question, if I could, has this been reviewed by the Legislative Revenue Office? Since pretty much all tax bills are, this is clearly a tax bill, Section 8 is. I mean, it may or not raise or lower revenue, but it definitely has an effect on the property tax and the way in which it's administered. I guess that's a speech rather than a question, but I would not be comfortable, Madam Chair, pursuing this amendment in this bill without it going through those other processes.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Parrish? Thank you.
And I will hang out till the 4143 when that comes up.
Okay. We're going to need to stand at ease for a second so I can find my vice chair.
Okay, I can overlook the bar.
Yeah. All right, we are back on, and committee, I think what I'm going to do is carry over the work session on this bill, 4079A, to our meeting tomorrow. With that, I'll close the work session. Right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 4085. Representative Rayfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of you should have in front of you, there's Dash 2 amendments, and what I'll do is I'll walk you very quickly through the Dash 2 amendments because we need to, at least when we're dealing with elections law, I think we need to bear with me to make a record on some of these things. You'll see as you go through this, we have from the underlying bill, we increased for independent expenditures, the reporting amount used to be $750. We have lowered that to $250 for independent expenditures reporting-wise here in the state of Oregon. The rationale for doing that is we have had a history of some local elections where a group of individuals have gotten together, say, in a city council race or a county commissioner races in other areas to affect change on a single policy issue. So, for instance, five people get together to spend $300 each because they want to essentially change a land use decision on various council levels. And so this is a way that voters can get access to this information where otherwise, under the current limits, they wouldn't have access to that information. And when we have a small group of people trying to affect change in the a local council level or even a county commission level, this level will allow us to achieve those goals. You'll see that we require for the independent expenditure side, we're asking that people keep the records for independent expenditures for 2 years. We're also putting together what we used to do, which is a spot check on independent expenditures to make sure that things are being done honestly. And that will be, and there's limits on how many transactions that we will be reviewing, so we're keeping it very narrowly tailored. We're also making sure that this is being done randomly. The Secretary of State will set up by rule procedures by which that this will be a random review, and so we're not specifically picking anyone under this. One of the other problems that we had in the past is the Secretary of State, when they would ask for information to review for campaign accounts or for independent expenditures, people would not respond. And the Secretary of State's had no ability to actually get these individuals to respond to the requests. So we put in a provision because of that problem. We put in a provision that allows them to issue a civil penalty under which their current civil penalty statutes to force compliance with their ability to request documents. One of the issues right now is our political committees are not being reviewed. In the past, we used to do spot checks of our political action committees, but essentially what we were doing is spot checking folks that were actually complying with the law. And if you're complying with the law, oftentimes you're not going to be able to find any differences. One of the things that we weren't doing is checking for the absence of information. So we would get complaints. There was really no way to verify some of that information. You would find that right now you could essentially take in $10,000 in contributions. You could spend that out of your bank account. If you didn't file it with Orstar, no one would ever know about it. What this allows us to do, or will allow the Secretary of State's office to actually examine accounts of political committees at random. And again, the Secretary of State has the ability to set a rule to, again, randomly select review of certain accounts. Essentially what they will be doing is looking for 3 months, say, of bank statements to make sure that everything that's coming in is being accounted for on Orstar and everything that's going out is being accounted for on Orstar. And that will give us a better level of compliance and ensuring that everybody is playing by the rules. We're putting sideboards on this where there's only a 3 month period where the examination would take place. It's kind of very simple to a random IRS audit that you would have now. As you go through some of the other things that you'll see, again, we put in the component for the civil penalty if people don't comply with the subpoena problem. One of the other problems that we had is when we had complaints being filed with the Secretary of State's office, there was really no way for them to investigate them in a thorough way. And so a lot of complaints weren't being completely investigated or they were being delayed. So we put a process by which that you would have the ability to request records for these complaints if there was reasonable suspicion that a violation of law had actually occurred. Again, we wanted to put some sideboards on it so we don't have to investigate, obviously fraudulent complaints, but when there's a level of suspicion that rises to reasonable suspicion, then the Secretary of State's office would be able to continue to investigate that to ensure compliance with our laws. The other thing that the bill does, as we had mentioned before, is right now we wanted to increase transparency with our independent expenditures. Right now, if you want to go into Orstar right now, it's very difficult to find this information. We're directing the Secretary of State's office to put in a separate line item on Orstar to where you would be able to click and type in somebody's name and find out all the independent expenditures that are being spent on a given campaign or who are being spent by a given individual. So the public will have greater access to dig into what is the impact of independent expenditures in our elections. And there is an empty, a blank amount for funds to basically put this into action, which is why there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this. And I believe that is everything on the dash twos.
Ah. That answers my question. Thank you.
I think it did mine also. So the dash two has the 250 because everything continues to be printed with the $50.
Correct. The dash two has the 250. And again, that was we reviewed our circumstances with some of the other case law that has been approved in the past. And this one fits the circumstances here in Oregon and also some of the case law.
Like a brief, you want to stand down for a minute? Is that what you're saying? Okay, sure. Can we take a, can we? All right, we are back on. I am going to carry over House Bill 4085 to tomorrow for a work session. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'm going to close the work session.
4085,
too?
Yeah.
We are.
Good. Let's make it a grand slam.
I am going to, tomorrow's just going to get longer and longer. I am going to open a work session on House Bill 4143. I'm going to ask John Van Landingham if he can come down and walk us through what's in the base bill and what is in the dash 14 amendments.
Okay.
And then you want this one.
Not a record.
Buddy. Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. I have done landlord-tenant law for almost 40 years. So it's easiest, I think, if you look at the A and Gross bill, because most of what the amendments do is take things out of the A and Gross bill. So it's easier to track that way. The bill initially started with five ideas that tenant advocates described as tenant protection measures. They have been reduced to two, and they are on the first page. They stay in the bill. They're on the first page of the A and Gross 4143. Those two changes are as follows. One, on rent increases, current law requires that a landlord who wants to raise a rent in a month-to-month tenancy, if it's a fixed-term tenancy, you can't raise the rent. You can't amend unilaterally a fixed-term tenancy, sometimes called a lease. In a month-to-month tenancy, the law allows a landlord to raise the rent on a written notice of at least 30 days. The first change that stays in this bill with the dash 14 amendments is to increase that 30-day period to 90 days. The second change is to say that in a month-to-month tenancy, during the first year of that month-to-month tenancy, a landlord can't raise the rent at all. That is comparable to an existing provision previously negotiated by landlord and tenant advocates with regard to security deposits. When a tenancy begins, most landlords charge a security deposit. Current law says a landlord can't increase the security deposit during the first year unless the deal changes. If the deal were to change, for example, a tenant says, I want to add a pet, wasn't permitted, then all bets are off and the landlord can charge more. But first year of a tenancy, no rent increase. That's the second change. What the amendments do is take out subsection 4 of the A and Gross bill and page 3, 4, 5, and most of 6. Those had to do with one of the third of the tenant protections. This one is going to be removed in the dash 4, and that was to increase the required amount of notice for a no-cause termination notice. No-cause termination notice means the landlord doesn't have to have a reason. The only defenses are that it's illegal retaliation, illegal discrimination. Current law requires that a no-cause termination notice be at least 30 days. The proposal in the bill was to say, let me back up. Current law says it must be at least 30 days during the first year of a tenancy. After the first year of a tenancy, a no-cause notice must be at least 60 days. There is one exception, and that exception is for if the landlord is selling the property to someone who intends, it's a single-family residence, the buyer intends to live in it. That stays at 30. But current law now says 30 during the first year of an occupancy, 60-day no-cause notice after that. This provision would have increased the 60 days after the first year to 90 days. That is being removed from the bill. So you've probably heard a lot of advocacy with regard to increasing the no-cause notice. That's out of the bill in the dash 14s. The going through again with the A and Gross bill, section 7 of the bill fixes something that the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and I'm the tenant leader of that coalition, brought to the legislature and got passed in 2015. It has to do with units that don't have an legal egress system. And it was brought to our attention by some advocates from Portland State University, where some landlords are renting out illegal basements. And there would be no way for a person to get out of that basement if there were a fire. So we didn't do that very well, and this fixes that. And it's agreed to by both landlord and tenant advocates. And then, not in the A4, but in the A14, is an amendment that was requested by one of the three statewide landlord organizations that has to do with fees that landlords can charge for noncompliance. Current law 90.302 narrowly regulates what landlords can charge fees for. One of those fees is for violating a rule against smoking in the dwelling unit. The this is a provision that was negotiated in the coalition. It requires a warning notice first, second offense, a $50 fee. This change would, for smoking, would increase that $50 fee to $250.
Thank That's you. It. Any questions? Thank you very much. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland Tualatin on House Bill 4143. This came to you not unanimously out of our housing committee, which unfortunately I wish it really could. I think the people on our committee do a pretty darn good job of trying to find ways to solve problems for housing. For the last few years, I've served on the ABC task force with Representative Reardon. So some of the things that you're seeing in the amendments that I brought to this bill came actually, some of it discussed in that task force. Some of it had been previously drafted in other pieces of legislation in different sessions. So really nothing that I'm asking for and the amendments was actually new, except for the dash 13s. The dash 13s is an incapacitation of the landlord in this particular, so we're making some expansions to providing notice. The dash 13s simply state that if the landlord dies, I don't necessarily want to inherit, if I was a landlord, inherit a tenant. If you have a family who's grieving, we want to be able to give people a way to start, you know, to get out of that lease. If the landlord is incapacitated, and that language came out of our existing statutes, or the landlord has disability, or if the landlord has a child or parent, and they actually need to, A, move back into the home themselves because they need to care for somebody, or B, they need to liquidate that asset so they can pay for a long-term care type situation for a child or a parent. So that came up out of some noise that I'd heard from folks, and I thought, you know, we at least need to have that one little, surety for people who are locking up a lot of their time and money into a long-term, sometimes not as easily liquid asset. So that's what the dash 13s are. There is a dash 10, which is the dash 8 for the bill that you already heard, so I won't describe that again, that county veterans piece. The dash 1 was something that came out of a lot of discussion. You know, I represent a district with a lot of mega churches, very big churches on 5-acre and 10-acre property. When we hear a lot about around inclusionary zoning, a lot of times it's because we want things like mixed neighborhoods and we want people to have access to better services. And so the dash 1 really was about the notion that if you had a church who otherwise is doing mission work and would like to be able to do housing as part of their mission, some of those churches in my community are right across the street from some of the best schools in the state. So one of them is actually running a very large food bank. And so what would it look like if we gave a rural residential exemption for emergency housing? They could put ADUs on that property. They can't currently do that under the code. And so the dash one would allow a way for some of the churches in Clackamas County who are sited on these really big tracts of otherwise just land that they're doing nothing else with. This is starting to bubble up as noise in churches in Clackamas County as trying to find ways to put more actual housing stock into the market. So that was a land use exemption ask that we were looking at. And the dash 2 is a little more complicated, but it is a low-income senior property tax freeze, which is different than our senior property tax deferral. This is really about that roll-up 3%, you know, property tax increase and keeping low-income seniors who are 70 or above, 300% or less of poverty actually in their home. So I know it has a property tax implication, which I'm sure Representative Barnhart will share his concerns about that. But, you know, when we talk about people who are actually in that that twilight age, and we know we're starting to see more seniors into our homelessness and services and struggling to stay in their homes, we know that their property taxes are going up at a faster clip than their incomes are growing. And so the notion that we would ask them to liquidate that property and move out of the house that they've lived in, some of them almost their whole lives, and watch that asset move from a hard asset into a liquid asset, get consumed in a senior type housing facility, and then at some point they're in our Medicaid system or Medicare system for long-term care or that type of skilled housing that they might need. That doesn't make a lot of long-term financial sense, so finding ways that we can keep low-income seniors in their homes did come up as several times in our some of the committee work and outside of that committee work, and so that's what those amendments are. I wanted to just certainly explain them Because I think as we are looking at housing, it needs to be sort of a balanced mix of what can we do for tenants, what can we do to make sure that we keep them, maintain that symbiotic relationships between landlords and tenants, which I have to say, having spent, this is my fourth year on housing and doing housing issues in this building, landlords and tenants in our state have been really good about finding ways to bring us consensus-based bills, and I've been on several of those bills and worked them through the system. Rep. Reardon and I had a bill last session, you might recall, where we gave a first right of refusal notice to nonprofits if nonprofits wanted to buy a piece of state land. Habitat for Humanity told me last week that they actually got that notice and they're looking to make a bid on that property. And so we know we need more land in the hopper. We know we need more on the supply side. And so I'd like to see us have a housing bill that actually balances sort of the supply with the with the tenant protection piece. And so that's what all those amendments are. But specifically, as it relates to this bill, I really do believe that Dash 13 is the incapacitation piece, death of a landlord piece. I think we need to give them some sort of coverage as we're asking them to do more as landlords. That piece should be in the mix.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. Parrish, I think you've got some interesting concepts. I'm going to kind of echo what Rep. Barnhart did a little bit ago about the oddity of coming in and having work sessions, and it's just were any of these presented in the public hearing to be vetted, or is this the first time they've debuted? And I guess the reason I'm asking, there are some interesting concepts there, but I spent a considerable amount of weekend going back and forth with constituents and partners, many of whom are in the room, figuring out, John was telling us everything that was coming out and what was going in, what was left, and what the parameters are. And
Representative Huffman, to answer your question, since I know where you're going with this, I would say no, they were not part of the negotiated settlement that came out of landlords with maybe the Speaker's office, because there wasn't, frankly, a Republican in that room. That was sort of negotiated outside of the process. And to the extent that these were on OLIS in our committee and did not get a hearing, they did not get a hearing, and which is why we're asking for some consideration again. Some of that was told to me was that the timeline was too short to move those things forward in a fast enough manner. But I will say they have been in other legislative concepts and other times. They have been talked about with folks who are interested in housing. So they weren't new concepts, but they certainly did not get the attention that I think that they deserved in the short session.
It's not really a question. I have to say I'm intrigued by the Dash 1 amendment. I don't think it doesn't fit with this particular bill that we're working on right now, but I will tell you that that this is a piece that may very well be worth considering further at a future time. Several of these ideas are ideas that I think are worth looking at with some care.
Representative Barnhart, I appreciate that. Madam Chair, I think we all want to go back to our communities and say that we worked on things that help solve a housing crisis. And we can disagree or agree on why we think there is one. I just think we need to find ways to put a lot in the mix, because inclusionary zoning could be a piece. We hear sometimes from advocates, well, there's only two states in the nation that do it. Well, Texas is the other state in the nation that doesn't have inclusionary zoning, and seven of the top 20 small cities in the nation for affordable housing are in Texas. So, we can have lots of philosophical debates about how to get there, but I think lots of things have to be on the table that deal with how do we keep tenants truly in their home. There are bad landlords. We did hear stories about bad landlords. There's bad tenants, frankly, too, sometimes. So, to try to go straight to the edge of legislation that, tries to get the bad landlords or even bad tenants and loop everybody into the mix and say they're all bad, so therefore we have to take our legislation to the furthest possible edge to solve a housing crisis, might not be the way to get there. I mean, frankly, in the city of Portland, when I look at policies that they've enacted that are things like, well, we'll let you just tear down one wall to the stud and rebuild the McMansion back in Portland. Sorry, that's an issue. When I look at the issue, there's a property tax issue where Multnomah County, for example, City Portland gave a lot of opportunity for putting ADUs into the mix, and Multnomah County came back around and said, oh, well, by the way, we're going to raise your property taxes because you did what the City of Portland wanted to do, but it triggered this weird property tax thing. And there's just lots of little strange bites and pieces to this that are problematic, and I think we have to, you know, really try to commit them from lots of different angles, but know that I think everyone's trying to come at it from the end shared outcome of, we want to make sure people have a home. And I've lived in times when I haven't had one. So to me, it's very personal, and I take, like, trying to solve it to the furthest possible extent of my time. You know, I live in a district where people aren't really struggling a whole lot with homelessness. But doesn't mean that I don't care about those issues, doesn't mean that I don't spend time on them, and I just think that there are lots of ways to slice the apple or climb to the top of the mountain or whatever expression you want to use, but that will get us there as long as we're willing to, you know, to try and come to the table and do that. And I think by and large, most times, the people all sitting behind me, some of them who've sat for, you know, up a couple years on committees and have watched them come and testify, and some of them have given their whole lives to doing this work, come with a servant's heart to try to make sure people have a home. I don't think any of us disagree on that. We might tactically disagree. I just want to put more tactics in the conversation.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a question. Are we planning on taking any more testimony today across the table?
I was not.
Okay.
We have somebody walk us through what the bill was and then Representative Parrish with her amendments.
Okay, thank you. I am prepared to make a few motions on amendments as we move along. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I try to do what I can on housing issues in the body based on where I'm placed, largely in ways and means, help get the $40 million. But, you know, like I said, like Representative Barnhart, some of the concepts are intriguing. And when you were talking about the churches with a lot of property and stuff, I don't know how it evolved, but my mind picture went immediately to Highland Baptist Church in Redmond. That I think is a great example of what you're talking about, and the surrounding housing and stuff is a good example. But housing is not going to be, like you said, not a single issue. It's going to be a lot of things that have to come together, and we have to, last year in Ways and Means, when we were going after $100 million and got $40 million for low-income housing, and now that, you know, the committee has got the rules written around how that money will be used, it's going to take a lot of partners at the table. You know, we can do some with inclusionary zoning and whatnot, but, you know, I gave the example, you can't have a city that has $25,000 per unit in SDCs and expect a developer to come up with low-income housing out of something like that. You've got to have help in a lot of different areas. So I appreciate the work you're doing and where you're headed, and I'd like to help in the future however I can help solve some of the problems.
Well, Representative Huffman, I live in a community where half an acre of dirt can cost $500,000. You're not building anything affordable there, yet we have good schools, we have good access to, you know, community services, and there's good access to jobs, and, you know, and that's, I would argue, is part of our UGB problem. But, you know, for those of us who are sort of banging that drum, but you know, so when I look at where can I site in my community something that is affordable, that maybe ties with a mission of one of my churches in the community, who are arguably, two of my churches run food banks, a bunch of them run other types of community services, and, you know, some childcare stuff going on in my community, like a lot of teen youth prevention of, you know, kids getting in trouble. This makes a lot of natural sense for some of the churches potentially in my community, and I know other churches in Clackamas are struggling with this too, trying to go like, we have this space, we can't do anything else with it. And the bill wouldn't let them ever sell, that amendment would not actually let them sell the property. It actually has to be like in sort of rental / emergency type housing. It would not be something that, well, we're going to put this ADU here and then we're going to sell it. That's not the intention of this. They couldn't do that under this amendment. So, I mean, and then when I look at, again, we've got great schools. And if somebody could tell me that inclusionary zoning was, we were going to put, you know, inclusionary zoning around Lincoln High School in Portland, you know, I'd probably vote for it, right? But how do you try to get that mixed-use housing where you are integrating people into communities? I think that's personally just really hugely important. I think the dash one gets us there. Shouldn't have a fiscal. It's really a permission thing. So, you know, to the extent that it does or doesn't fit in the bill, maybe it doesn't because the bill got a name, Tenant Protection Act, but the fact is the relating to clause says as it relates to housing. And so if we're, in my mind, if we're serious about housing, we try to put as much into the hopper that is as hopefully not controversial as possible to try to impact and move the dial as quickly as we can for an issue we know is a huge problem right now. So I think we all agree on that, no matter where we're at in the building. Thanks.
With that, Madam Chair, I move the dash A14 amendments to House Bill 4143A.
Vice Chair Hoyle has moved the dash 14 amendments to House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion? Zoe, can you call? Oh.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
No.
Representative Rayfield.
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Excused.
Chair Williamson.
Aye. All right. Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to move the A1 or the dash one amendments into House Bill 4143.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash, which one?
Dash one.
Dash one amendment into House Bill 4143. Zoe, can you call the roll?
Oh.
Discussion.
Discussion. Discussion.
I've
had a chance to look briefly at the dash one amendment. I'm intrigued by the dash one amendment, but there are also issues, I think, that need to be vetted, and it's just not ready. I'm looking, for example, at the affordable housing units definition on line 3. I don't know whether that's the right definition to use or not. I think we need some testimony on it. And there are other issues throughout this amendment that are, I think, at least details need some work. I'm not going to support the amendment today because I just don't think it's ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like I told Representative Parrish, some of what she presented, I think, has a lot of merit, and we should be looking at that in the future, but spending a lot of time over the weekend and getting constituent input on what I thought we were going to be looking at today, I can't support anything outside of the dash 14.
No.
Representative Huffman.
No.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield.
No.
Representative Smith Warner.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Excuse.
Chair Williamson.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to move the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 4143, please.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I'm going to adopt Representative Huffman's comment on the last amendment on other amendments that get made, including the dash 2.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Zoe, can you call the roll?
Representative
Thank you.
Barnhart.
No.
Representative Huffman.
No.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield.
No.
Representative Smith Warner.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Excused.
Chair Williamson.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
I'd like to move the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 4143.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion? Zoe, can you call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
No.
Representative Huffman.
No.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Wakefield.
No.
Representative Smith Warner.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Excused.
Chair Williamson.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'd like to move the dash 10 amendments to House Bill 4143.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash 10 amendments into House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion? Representative Rayfield.
The only thing, Madam Chair, that I would note is there's two different dash 10 amendments with different dates on them, and we might want to clarify which dates we're talking about.
There's two different dash 10 amendments with different dates on them.
Oh, okay. I'd be more than happy to take the one with the latest date.
Okay. Representative Rayfield, do you have that date?
And it is February 10th, 2016.
So Representative Wilson has moved the dash 10 amendments dated February, what was it again?
10th.
10th, 2016 into House Bill 4143A. Any more discussion? Barbara Smith Warner.
Both of the ones I see are dated the 8th. On OLIS.
That's the...
The lower one on the
one
list?
One near the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
and Madam Chair, I'm looking actual the meeting date post date as opposed to the posted date and time.
Staff, can I presume that whatever's further
I think he's looking
OLIS?
At the date they are uploaded versus the date.
Okay, yeah, so it would be the 8th. It would be the 8th, okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
It was uploaded twice, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, the same amendment.
Is it the same amendment?
I think so.
Two different dates.
Yeah.
So the correct amendment is the 2-8-16. You might want to correct that motion.
2-8-16. All right.
I would just say we just correct it.
So Representative Wilson has moved the dash 10 amendments from 2-8-16 into House Bill 4143.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is another amendment that has to do with ad valorem taxation, veterans, surviving spouses, and the such. And as such, it ought to be vetted through the Revenue Committee and especially through the Legislative Revenue Office to make certain that it actually does operate in the way that it appears to. It may be a fantastic idea, but I don't think we ought to be trying to add it to a bill today.
Wilson.
Madam Chair, I would just say that if we could be consistent in this body, that would be wonderful. But we have inconsistencies everywhere we turn in this short session about where bills are routed. And if this is seems unusual, I would contest that. I think it's par for the course.
Session. Zoe, can you call the roll?
No.
Representative Hoffman.
No.
Representative Penner.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield.
No.
Representative Smith-Warner.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Excused.
Chair Williamson.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'd like to move the dash 13 amendments into House Bill 4143.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash 13 amendments into House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion?
To clarify, Madam Chair, the dash A13.
A13?
What are my choices?
that would be your choice,
say
Representative.
I didn't bring my computer. Yeah. So. All right. So I will clarify that. Representative Wilson has moved the dash A13 amendments into House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion? Zoe, can you call the roll? Thank you.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Rayfield?
No.
Representative Smith Warner?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Excused.
Chair Williamson.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair, for one final time.
Excellent. Representative Wilson.
I'd like to move the dash 15 amendments into House Bill 4143.
Representative Wilson has moved the dash 15 amendment to House Bill 4143A. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, same A. Clarification.
A15.
Thank you.
The A15. Any discussion? Zoe, can you call the roll? Thank you.
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Rayfield?
No.
Representative Smith Warner?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Excused.
Chair Williamson?
No. Motion fails.
Ready for her.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4143A with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle has moved House Bill 4143A with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just a matter of caution, if I could, it's a question.
Yes, Representative.
A bunch of these other bills needed to go to Ways and Means. I take it this one does not.
This one does not.
Thank you.
This is going straight to the floor. Any other discussion? All right, Zoe, can you call the, oh, Representative Barbara Smith Warner.
I was just going to clarify again. So this is the as amended with the
dash
A14. Thank you.
Any other discussion?
Right. Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
No.
Representative Rayfield. Representative Smith Warner.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
No, and serve notice of filing a minority report.
Yes.
Excused.
Chair Williams.
Yes. Motion passes. We will figure out a carrier later.
Chair, I join on the.
Thank you. Rick, do you want to walk us through the timing on a minority report on the record?
Thank you, Chair. Since notice has been given on the record, you have until 5 o'clock tomorrow, the first business day, to return both the minority amendment and the signed minority report that will require both your signatures. We will run that off and get it to both of you tomorrow early for signature.
All right, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session. I think, Rick, that's all we've got, right?
That's it.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, that we're adjourned. Adjourned.
That's
right?
It.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, that we're